Chapter 13. The Golden Cape. Harnessing Spider Silk. The Cape. Weaving spiders come not here. Hence, you long-legged spinners, hence. William Shakespeare, A Midsummer Night's Dream, 1595-6. In January 2012, something new and extraordinary was unveiled at the V&A Museum in London. A glossy, calf-length cape, the colour of country butter, covered with traceries of embroidery. In shape, it was something like a priest's chasuble, a long silken oblong folded in half, with a hole in the middle for the wearer's head, and a cascade of foot-long tassels down the front, all in precisely the same shade. It was an exhibit to remember. Both the colour and the craftsmanship drew the eye. Up close, visitors could see exquisite appliqué flowers and arachnids creeping over its surface. And as they learned more, they were further entranced. The cape had taken a team of hundreds over 3 years to make. Most astounding of all, however, was that this cape was made entirely of raw, undyed spider silk. As the cape's creators explained, this was not the first time they had tangled with this incredible fabric. Simon Piers, a British textile expert, and Nicholas Godley, an American designer, both based in Madagascar, had, some 4 years previously, completed a rich tapestry using the stuff. It was 335 by 122 centimetres, spun from the silk of around 1.2 million spiders, and had been put on view at the American Museum of Natural History on the Upper West Side, just beside Central Park in Manhattan. There it was billed as a cultural curiosity rather than a milestone in fabric history. Its abstract geometric brocaded patterns echoed those popular in Madagascar in the 19th century. It had taken craftsmen 5 years to make and had cost over $500,000. Perhaps this was in part why the pair were unsatisfied. Yes, they had created something unique from a material that has remained so maddeningly out of reach for centuries. But, to their minds, a question still lingered. What would it be like to wear something made from the stuff of cobwebs? The idea of being wrapped, cocooned in spider silk, Piers says, has a lot of resonance. The idea of a cape appealed too. On a purely pragmatic level, it has a large surface area to decorate, which would allow them to demonstrate the skill of the team of weavers and embroiderers they worked with in Madagascar. But there were other connotations that Piers and Godley wanted to explore. Capes are, on the one hand, the stuff of Marvel comic book heroes, of futuristic super beings capable of saving the day. On the other, particularly when spun from golden thread, they recall the fairy tales and half-remembered stories and myths of childhood. The quest to make the garments shown in the V&A led Piers and Godley to extremes, but in this, they are far from alone. The lure of spider silk as a reliable, sustainable resource has been capturing imaginations for centuries. Although you might not think it, the quotidian cobwebs unthinkingly brushed away from countless corners are wonders of engineering. Made entirely of protein, spider silks are incredibly tough and can stretch up to 40% of their relaxed length without breaking. This, of course, makes them of interest to those seeking breakthroughs in medical and military biotechnology, and suggested uses have ranged from nerve regeneration to replacements for Kevlar in bulletproof vests via luxury clothing. Small wonder, then, that in seeking to replicate what the humblest spider can do in the blink of one of its eyes, people have always been prepared to go to extraordinary lengths. Arachnids and arachnophobia. Do you not see how the spider weaves a web so subtle that man's hand cannot imitate it? This art is born, not taught. Seneca, Moral Letters to Lucilius, Letter 121. The spiders responsible for the raw material used to make the golden cape were Nephila madagascariensis, a kind of golden orb weaver and, as the name suggests, a native of Madagascar. They are charismatic creatures as spiders go. The females are the size of a human palm, with long, rather elegant legs that jag out above their bodies. Their plump and rather beautiful yellow and grey spotted abdomens range in size from Brazil nuts to large dates. The males are reddish-brown and a mere 50th of the size. They are also incredible web weavers, constructing vast nests all around Antananarivo, Madagascar's capital, in trees and at the top of telephone poles, lying in wait for their prey, head down in webs that gleam golden in the sunshine. The Nephila genus is one of the oldest known still around today. Their fossil records date back 165 million years to the Middle Jurassic period. They're popular with collectors and museums because of the females' showy good looks and their habit of displaying gruesome trophies, such as butterfly wings and fly heads, in their webs, as a proud hunter might do with antlers. Subspecies can be found across the world, from the Americas via Asia to Australia. They are notorious for spinning webs across paths, where they are frequently crashed into by joggers. Errant joggers, however, emerge relatively unscathed. Their bites may cause nausea and dizziness, but aren't serious, because Nephila are after other prey. Insects usually, but small birds and lizards, and even the occasional ill-fated male Nephila, have fallen to the neurotoxic venom they use to dispatch anything trapped in the web's sticky embrace. Their name, derived from two Greek words, roughly translates as fond of spinning. And as this suggests, Nephila are renowned for their silk. Their webs, created exclusively by the females, are vast, up to 2 meters across. They seem rather proud of their silken achievements. They rarely leave, even when attacked. And although an entirely new web can be woven in little over half an hour if one is destroyed, they generally prefer to mend and make do. As sections become damaged, the female will consume the silk and patch up the area with freshly spun thread. Their elegantly structured webs are much admired by scientists for their strength, precision, and distinctive golden colour, which is thought to help attract prey. Male spiders spend their lives skittering around the web's peripheries, anxiously waiting. Neither sex lives more than a few months, so time is precious, for an opportune moment to mate without attracting either the ire or appetite of the fairer sex. If mating is successful, egg sacs, wrapped in hanks of yet more golden silk, are hidden a little way away from the webs, ready to unleash hundreds of pin-sized spiderlings that will grow to become the next generation. Spiders are remarkable. Over the course of a single night, and using only a self-generated material, many species can build a vast multi-purpose structure. To put it in human terms, it's like making a web the size of a football pitch and then using it to catch prey equivalent in mass to an aeroplane. Dating back nearly 380 million years, they have evolved into over 40,000 separate species. For the sake of comparison, humans diverged from chimpanzees just 7 million years ago, and there are just 400 different primates. All spiders use silk at some point in their life cycles, and individuals can produce different types depending on the use they wish to put it to. From building bolt holes in the earth and creating cocoons for their eggs to enveloping prey. Even a single web will be made up of different kinds. The radiating spokes are generally major ampullate silk, which is also the type that spiders use when they drop suddenly to get out of harm's way. This is the strongest kind. The spiral is made from flagelliform, which is stretchy but springs back relatively slowly, so that prey doesn't just bounce off. Just to make sure, it is usually seeded with special sticky droplets. Each strand is made from outlandishly long, complex and repetitive proteins, which the spider creates in the hundreds of translucent glands within their abdomens. These glands are connected to microscopic spinnerets, where the liquid protein is squeezed out at will to become silk fibers. As well as being large, the silk proteins are also unstable. The molecular transformation from liquid to solid takes place at the very moment the spider spins and is due to the shape and pressure in the spinnerets themselves. Although similar to the silk made by silkworms, the spider's product is superior. On a molecular level, it is finer and more even, making it softer and lighter in thread and fabric form. Although finer than a human hair, some spider silks are, weight for weight, around 5 times stronger than steel, can be incredibly elastic, don't trigger an allergic reaction in humans, and are able to absorb vast amounts of kinetic energy. This combination of qualities has led those studying it to posit its use in everything from structural blast protection to bulletproof vests and body armor, biodegradable fishing lines to artificial tendons and the finest silk shirts the world has ever known. Old yarns. I wove my webs for you because I liked you. After all, what's a life anyway? We're born, we live a little while, we die. E.B. White, Charlotte's Web, 1952. Our species has grown up watching spiders. All the while, we struggled to master tools that would help us hunt, cook, and sew. We were surrounded by pristine webs, each beaded by the body of its maker. It's no wonder that these creatures are woven so deeply in our psyches. We have had much to learn from their self-sufficiency, their efficiency, their creativity, and perhaps especially, their peerless prowess with silk. Democritus, a Greek philosopher born around 460 BC, suggested that it was watching spiders make their webs and spin their egg sacs that gave humans the idea to spin and weave themselves. It's certainly true that there is a relationship. Some argue that spiders were originally called spinders from the word spin. Weavers weren't the only ones watching them. It is hard not to speculate, for example, that hunters and fishermen owe the development of nets, traps, and lures in part to studying spiders. Perhaps because of their dual role as makers and destroyers, arachnids appear in the creation myths of cultures including the people of pre-Columbian Peru, the Akan in Ghana, and some Native American tribes. The Hopi and Navajo, for example, have envisaged a spider-woman hybrid who was responsible for weaving the cosmos from clouds and rainbows on an enormous loom, and whose generosity with her wisdom and skill allowed humanity to flourish on Earth. Tribal weavers, hoping to tap into the skill of this deity, would rub their hands in spiderwebs before they set to work. Neith, an ancient Egyptian goddess of wisdom, hunting and weaving, was associated with spiders, as was Utu, a Mesopotamian goddess in charge of everything pertaining to women. So close was their bond that the same symbol was often used to denote both Utu's name and the word spider. In China, spiders were traditionally symbolic of industry and were considered good luck. Spiders have played positive roles in popular Western culture too. The nursery rhyme, Itsy Bitsy Spider, is used to teach children about tribulation and determination. In Charlotte's Web, the spider Charlotte is the agent of Wilbur the Pig's salvation. Since being launched in the summer of 1962, Spider-Man, the alter ego of the mild-mannered Peter Parker, has become one of the most beloved characters in the comic book firmament. Stan Lee, the character's creator, said often that he was inspired by watching a spider climb up a vertical wall. Spider-Man can do the same. He also shoots web-like ropes from his wrists and uses them to pinion criminals and to fly through the urban jungle. but admiration is often accompanied, or even superseded, by revulsion and fear. Sympathy for Itsy Bitsy withers the moment we learn about Little Miss Muffet. In a more sinister and blood-curdling vein is the Swiss writer Jeremias Gotthelf's 1842 novella, The Black Spider. In it, he envisioned a spider blooming blackly on the cheek of a woman kissed by the devil. Eventually, it hatches and wreaks havoc on the area, killing cattle and people indiscriminately. Spider women, despite their association with creation, are not always benign. The Jorogumo, literally whore spider of Edo period Japan, 1615 to 1868, would trick naive samurai warriors by appearing as a seductive woman before wrapping them in silk to devour later. This is echoed by the trope of black widows, Debbie from Adam's Family Values, Betty Lou Beats, Mary Elizabeth Wilson, women who murder their unsuspecting spouses. This is lent both legitimacy and piquancy by the fact that in many spider species, N. madagascarienis included, sexual cannibalism is not infrequent. The ancient Greek legend of Arachne is another example of the treacherous cultural link between women and spiders. Like any myth worth retelling, this one has several variations, but all start with Arachne, a poor young woman who from a young age showed extraordinary skill on the loom. She was very proud of her talent, though, something that generally bodes ill for women in traditional tales. When a family friend suggests that Athena herself, goddess of reason and the arts, must have taught her, Arachne scoffs. Quite the contrary, she boasts. Athena could learn a thing or two about weaving from her. Gods and goddesses are quick to punish uppity mortals. Athena appears at the cottage door in disguise and challenges Arachne to a weaving contest. Whoever loses can touch neither loom nor spindle until their dying day. The goddess wins, of course, but takes pity on Arachne, who is distraught at the thought of never practicing her craft again. Athena's mercy, however, is tinged with malice. In order to cheat the terms of the bargain and yet still spin to her heart's content, Arachne is transfigured from beautiful woman into a spider. Going for a spin. This promises to be a fibre of commerce of the future. J.F. Duthie, 1885. It is a small step from imitation to appropriation, and neither the squeamishness we feel about spiders nor an endless list of technical difficulties have prevented people from trying to harness their silk. Islanders in the Southwest Pacific traditionally used it to make fishing lines, and across Africa, webs and cocoons have been harvested to fashion everything from purses to hats. There is a Botswanian example of the latter, topped with an exclamatory ostrich feather at the British Museum. Many cultures have used them to dress wounds, a practice that was well known in Shakespeare's day. "I shall desire you of more acquaintance, good Master Cobweb," Bottom says in A Midsummer Night's Dream. "If I cut my finger, I shall make bold with you." Indeed, the threads do have antiseptic qualities. 18th century Europeans, resenting China's stranglehold on the silk industry and desperately trying to foster a viable alternative, thought that spiders might offer the answer for a silk industry of their own. Individual silken threads, because they are so fine, were even used to make crosshairs in gun sights up until the 1960s. Despite this bounty of applications, ambitious commercial attempts to use them have usually foundered. The problem is that it's extremely difficult to scale up production. To make spider silk a viable alternative to that of silkworms, you need to do more than collect cobwebs and cocoons. You need to get the silk directly from the source and in large quantities. François Xavier Bon, a French aristocrat, was one of the first to seriously explore spider sericulture. A long report, first published in French in 1709 and later translated into English, outlined his findings. He was hampered in his efforts by his lack of basic knowledge about spiders. He wrote, for example, that all spiders were androgynous, believing that it was generally the males that laid the eggs. He also struggled to describe the spinnerets, settling for comparisons from human anatomy. All spiders spin their thread from the anus, about which there are 5 papillae, or small nipples. Nevertheless, he persisted. By collecting egg sacs, or bags as he called them, from the corners of windows or vaults, or under the eaves of houses, he gleaned enough to make a pair of stockings and gloves, which he excitedly presented to the scientific community as proof that the age of the silkworm might finally be drawing to a close. Despite this initial promise, though, efforts soon stalled when the magnitude of the obstacles became apparent. It was estimated, for example, that it would take 12 spiders to produce enough silk to equal the output of a single cocoon of the Bombyx mori silkworm, and 27,648 to produce a single pound of silk. It was also discovered that spiders were deeply resistant to being farmed. For one thing, it was well nigh impossible to catch enough flies to feed such vast numbers of them. Worse still was their tendency to attack and kill one another when confined together. "Every time I looked upon them," wrote one researcher despairingly, "I saw a small one become the prey of a larger one, and some time after, I had hardly above 1 or 2 left in each box." Still, the idea refused to peter out completely. Innovators, inventors, and scientists worried at it again and again, often unaware of their predecessors' attempts, and each convinced that they had stumbled on the holy grail of the fabric industry, a thread that could rival Chinese silk. Gifts of spider silk curiosities were given to the rich and powerful in the hope that they would fund further experiments. François Xavier Bon is thought to have given a pair of stockings to the Duchess of Bourgogne, gloves to the Empress of Germany and Austria, and a waistcoat to King Louis XIV himself. The closest historical attempts to reach some measure of success were those of the French colonial administration in Madagascar in the late 19th century. Jacob-Paul Cambouis, a French missionary living on the island, pioneered methods of extracting silk from living spiders in the 1880s and 1890s. He had initially tried to just use the cocoons, as is done for regular silk, but found that 50 of them yielded just a single gram of silk. If a spider was held still and the silk pulled from its spinnerets directly, however, the thread extracted could be anywhere from 80 to 700 meters. Mr. Noguet, his colleague, built a contraption that, while it looked sinister, allowed N. madagascariensis spiders to be silked in groups without being harmed. Silk collected in this fashion in Antananarivo was made into bed hangings that were displayed with much fanfare at the Exposition Universelle in Paris in 1900, before disappearing without a trace. For Simon Piers, who lived and worked in Madagascar producing textiles, rumours of the island's spider silk weaving past were like a fairy tale, often heard but never fully believed. He was both fascinated and enchanted. In the 1990s, he fashioned a Heath Robinson-style recreation of Mr. Noguet's spider silking contraption that would hold 2 dozen spiders safe and still while their silk was pulled out and loosely spun into a thread. It was only years later, with the encouragement and backing of Nicholas Godley, that Piers's efforts to create a spider silk textile began in earnest. Their first textile was completed in 2008. The final goal, making a piece of clothing entirely from spider silk, took 3 more years. Even with the pair's hard-won experience and the honed skills of their team, it was a laborious endeavour. In part, this was because they felt the weight of their predecessors' failed attempts sitting heavily on their shoulders. The realization of hundreds of years of dreams had to be something special. To achieve a suitably impressive garment, they used 2 different types of weaving, and covered the entire surface with intricate embroidery and appliqué. The decoration alone took many thousands of hours of stitching, all done by hand. While all this certainly helped get the point across, even the humblest of threads woven into the hem was a labour of love. Because spider silk is so fine, it would be near impossible to work with on its own. Each thread was twisted together from the silk of 24 spiders, and that was just the basic thread. The brocaded ground required far more. Each warp thread was comprised of 96 separate strands, while the weft contained twice as many. Bearing in mind that it takes around 14,000 spiders to get just 1 ounce of silk, simply getting enough silk was a huge endeavour. Each morning, a small army of between 30 and 80 people would be dispatched to gather up to 3,000 spiders from the trees and telephone poles of Antananarivo. These would then be silked, using a machine similar to the one Simon Piers had made years earlier, before being returned to the areas in which they were caught in the afternoon. After being so depleted, it would take the spiders a week or so to restock their silk supplies, after which time they could be caught and silked again. When it was finally completed and put on display for 6 months in the V&A Museum in London in 2012, the cape made a lasting impression on those who saw it. For many, though, particularly once the golden cape was packed away back into storage, the impossible lure of spider silk remained undimmed. Of course, a garment had been created, but only one, and at vast expense, requiring a team that numbered in the hundreds. The bigger challenge remained: to produce the silk in larger quantities, unlocking its potential so that it was no longer in the realm of one-off museum exhibits, but could become part of the fabric of the everyday. Emperor's New Threads. Spider silk and goat milk, it turns out, aren't all that different. Dr. Geoffrey Turner, CEO of Nexia Biotechnologies, 2001. In the first month of the new millennium, Nexia Biotechnologies, a somewhat secretive firm operating out of a maple farm in rural Canada, made an announcement. They had finally pioneered a way of producing spider silk in large quantities. Their secret method did not involve an especially docile nor an especially large spider, but another animal entirely: goats. Nexia had spliced the silk-making genes of golden orb-weaving spiders into the genetic makeup of the goats. When the females, the three most famous were called Freckles, Pudding, and Sweetie, lactated, their milk contained spider silk protein. To get at the silk, the goats were milked and then the protein extracted and spun into thread, for which Nexia coined a suitably Marvel comic book-sounding name: BioSteel. Financial backing for the project had come from the American military, whose interest was piqued when they discovered that some spider silks were 5 times tougher than the Kevlar used in normal body armour. At first, the world was enthralled. Finally, it seemed as if people might at last get their hands on a fabric it has taken spiders 380 million years to perfect. Sadly, tales of limitless spider silk spun from the milk of nanny goats turned out to be mirages. Nexia went bankrupt in 2009. A fundamental problem for scientists and companies seeking to recreate this silk is the sheer size and complexity of the proteins it is made from. Although they vary enormously depending on the species of spider, diet, and the kind of silk being produced, the molecular structure often includes many different proteins in complicated sequences, making them fiendishly difficult to replicate in a lab. Another hurdle is the instability of spider silk. When formed, it is a liquid, constantly teetering on the edge of becoming a solid, and only doing so in spiders as it passes through the spinnerets, which apply a mechanical pressure in a way that is not fully understood. For arachnids, this liquid-to-solid property makes sense, as the liquid silk dope can be easily stored in their bodies and spun into thread on demand. For human imitators, however, it is a formidable obstacle, and so far has proved impossible to reproduce in machines. Despite such difficulties, Nexia are far from the only company willing to risk financial ruin and public ridicule to overcome them. Dr. Randy Lewis, a molecular biologist at the Utah State University, bought the spider goat herd in 2009 and continued this avenue of research. Not that he has put all his egg sacs in one basket. While freckles and pudding might be the most photogenic subjects in his work, Dr. Lewis is also looking at other organisms whose genes might be coaxed into making them unlikely silk producers. Potatoes, alfalfa, a member of the pea family, and even Escherichia coli, a bacterium that causes food poisoning. A simpler solution, and one that is being explored by several different firms, involves altering the genes of silkworms. Domesticated silkworms, Bombyx mori, are already incredibly efficient silk producers. Around 40% of their body weight is devoted to silk glands, and the skills needed to handle them are already widespread. If the genes of B. mori could be hijacked to produce spider-type silk successfully, they would slot neatly into existing supply chains. Not everyone is as optimistic as Dr. Lewis. Fritz Vollrath is a German-born biologist who has been studying spiders and their silk for 2 decades. Perhaps his most famous piece of research involved dosing spiders with different drugs, LSD, amphetamines, caffeine, and so on, to see what effect this would have on the webs they built. The caffeinated spider's web, incidentally, was the most haphazard. The professor now leads the Oxford Silk Group, a research lab that for the past 15 years has specifically studied the chemistry, physics, evolution, and ecology of silk using a large brood of golden orb weavers housed in a converted greenhouse on a roof in Oxford. Unlike Dr. Lewis and many of the other companies involved in producing spider silk products, Professor Vollrath is much more downbeat. Worse than a pipe dream is his opinion of the idea that tendons might be produced using synthetic silk. He's even franker about the notion that it could be used to replace Kevlar. It's bullshit. People are excited about it because people are stupid. Yes, spider silk would be strong enough to stop a bullet, he argues, but only once it had gone through a body, because silk is stretchy, which would rather defeat the object of the exercise. But his problem with the hype surrounding synthetic spider silk goes beyond the things that some have suggested might be made with it, right to the heart of the product itself. He contends that scientists, whatever they say in press releases, are unable to replicate the stuff that real arachnids produce because it is simply too complicated. In his view, what they have been able to do is copy a few peptide motifs from larger spider silk protein sequences. Calling fragments of what makes spider silk, Professor Vollrath says, is what is now called an alternative fact. Even once you've found a way of getting goats, E. coli, or potatoes to express these protein fragments, you still don't have a viable product. Extracting the specific spider-copied protein from something else is a difficult and harsh process, often involving acid baths. And this process denatures the protein, essentially killing it and making it impossible to spin into thread. This tangle of conflicting narratives about the future of spider silk is heightened because the field of study is still new and small, and because the commercial companies working on creating products are relatively opaque. Triumphant press releases are followed by months, even years, of silence. It certainly makes sense to remain skeptical, but even naysayers argue that spider silk is still worth studying. The work done by researchers and companies trying to make spider silk greatly expands our knowledge of biopolymers, those proteins that are made from spider silk motifs and might lead to new ones. The Oxford Silk Group has also pioneered a method of silking individual spiders by tethering them on their backs, unharmed, while a slow mechanized winch draws out and winds the spider's silk onto a reel, a process that for some spiders can last up to 8 hours of continuous silk production. Even if Professor Volrath is a cynic when it comes to much of what is claimed for spider silk, there are plenty of avenues he believes are worth exploring. Most of these are medical. Spider silk is naturally antibacterial and antiseptic. It also has a unique compatibility with human cells, which means that our bodies don't reject it. Oxford Biomaterials, a commercial spin-off from Professor Volrath's research group, is currently trialling spider silk as scaffolding for nerve regeneration and experimenting with using it to help create heart muscle. The ultimate aim is to repair damaged spinal cords. Spin doctors. You can do anything in a test tube. It takes a lot more to do it at scale. Jamie Bainbridge, VP of Product Development at Bolt Threads, 2016. Bolt Threads, the most recent and charismatic firm to enter the spider silk production fray, has other ambitions. Headed by three scientists who met while at university, Bolt's headquarters in Emeryville, California, eschew a textile factory or workshop aesthetic in favor of one that combines the characteristics of a science lab with those of a can-do tech startup. All the conference rooms are named after different fabrics: velvet, silk, jacquard, and a copy of Charlotte's Web sits on the table in the lobby. At their desks, staff wear the Silicon Valley uniform of jeans and hoodies. There's a fridge filled with free bottled drinks, all of them sugar-free. In the labs, clear Perspex specs and personalized white coats must be worn. Voices are hushed, beakers clink, and machines, named for Jupiter's moons in one room, comic book characters in another, whir. On the 16th of June 2015, Dan Widmeyer, the CEO and co-founder, triumphantly announced that the Bolt team had, after 6 years of research, cracked one of nature's toughest puzzles, to wit: making the silk without the spiders. They had spurned goats, alfalfa, and E. coli in favor of a combination of sugar, water, salt, and yeast, and although they are honest about the challenges of making spider silk synthetically, are adamant that they have, at long last, managed to do so at a commercially viable scale. For Widmeyer, synthetic spider silk has been an ambition since his days at UC San Francisco. During his time in academia, he was unable to make more than 100 milliliters, and he became convinced that to get the resources he needed would require starting a business. Now Bolt Threads claim to have succeeded in making about 4,000 kinds of spider silk from different species. Their mainstay, though, and the one they use as the basis for most of the fabrics they hope to get to market, is a riff on the dragline silk from another orb weaver from the genus Argiope. This would allow them to create, as Widmeyer put it, programmable polymers with a nearly limitless array of properties. In theory, they could tweak the threads they create to be odor-resistant, antimicrobial, lighter, stronger, or stretchier, depending on the use they were being put to. Price-wise, Bolt Threads can't rival cotton or polyester. Polyester is down to $1 or $2 a kilo, explains Jamie Bainbridge, Bolt's Vice President of Product Development. Ours is not going to be a commodity product. It's going to be a premium product. They are understandably cagey about the technical side of what they do, but Bainbridge is confident that they have cracked the thorny issue of protein extraction and have processes for coagulating the protein from liquid to solid refined to a commercially viable degree. The key to this stage, according to Widmeyer, lay in being able to utilize pressures and temperature on the viscous liquid silk in ways that spiders are simply unable to. In its base form, the silk protein resembles powdered milk. This must then be dissolved in acid before being spun and re-solidified in yet another solution. On the day I visited, the thread that was emerging inch by inch was a bright golden yellow. Spools of thread in other colors, teal, pink, and a pearly white, and knitted samples lay on lab surfaces, Unlike silkworm silk, which is difficult to dye, Bolt Thread's creation is far easier to colour. The fibres produced are thick and solid enough to be handled by standard commercial knitting and weaving equipment. The items they have made so far have been knitted. Limited edition runs of lustrous ties and wool blend hats, sold through the Best Made brand that Bolt quietly acquired in July 2017, and a collaboration with Stella McCartney. Backstage at her show in Paris in October 2017, the British designer showed off a bodysuit and trousers in pansy brown silk knit. Another of her designs, a golden dress, is now in the collection of the MoMA. However tantalizingly close Bolt Threads might be to producing spider-inspired silk, it is materializing only slowly, and the world is getting impatient. When might people expect to see spider silk clothes in shops? That is a question I would pay every journalist not to ask, Bainbridge says. The company's research is still ongoing, and science takes its own time. Until Bolt or another company, AM Silk in Germany and Spiber, a Japanese company, are inching towards the same goal, succeed, then spider silk garments will remain the stuff of museum collections and novelty items. The golden cape, the bounty of over 1 million golden orb weavers, is currently out of the public eye in storage in London, although it will soon emerge for exhibitions in Canada and elsewhere. That's not the end of the story, though, Simon Pierce tells me, sounding both reassuring and hopeful. There will be a future for both the cape and the textile, but it's an ongoing saga.